Okay, I'd like to get started again. Thank you. For this last session, Standard Setting Accomplishments and Priorities, this session will be moderated or co-chaired by both Greg Skates and I in the Office of Chief Auditor. This session, as many of you may know, we normally, at our last meeting of the year, talk about our standard setting priorities and accomplishments as the first session, and we flipped it because we really thought, given the current economic environment, that that subject really deserved attention as first on our list. And so just based on scheduling, this is where this fell. So this is also an important topic to us, and we will be presenting you with our outline of activities over the past year, as well as what we're proposing to do going forward. So with that, I'll turn it over to Greg to start us off.
Okay. Thank you, Jennifer. As Jennifer mentioned, we want to talk about the standard-setting priorities for the upcoming year. First, I'd like to start with a report on our standards-related accomplishments to date this year, followed by an overview of the topics the board believes should have the highest priority. After some brief remarks, then we will open the floor up to discussion, and we would like to have your input at that time. The significant standards-related accomplishments since last year's annual SAG meeting indicate where the standard-setting staff and the board have devoted their attention and resources. Many of these accomplishments relate directly to the priorities that were discussed last year. The first of our slides includes a listing of these accomplishments. Earlier this week, the board proposed for public comment, seven auditing standards that collectively would update the requirements for assessing and responding to risk during an audit. This has been a significant project, and it addresses core concepts underlying the audit, such as identifying and assessing risk of material misstatement, the auditor's responses to the risk of material misstatement, evaluating audit results, audit planning and supervision, consideration of materiality and planning and performing an audit, audit evidence and audit risk, and an audit of financial statements. Future auditing standards would build on the fundamental principles in these proposed standards. We believe that the board's proposed risk assessment standards, if adopted by the board, would result in improvements to audits and issuers in several ways. First, the proposed standards would update the existing requirements to take account of the improved risk-based audit methodologies currently in use by some of the auditors. Second, the proposed standards should enhance the integration of the audit of the financial statements with the audit of internal control over financial reporting, resulting in more effective audits. Improvements in the standards also address financial statement-only audits. Third, the proposed auditing standards would integrate the auditor's current responsibilities for considering the risk of fraud during the audit. This integration would emphasize that consideration of fraud is a central part of the audit process and should prompt auditors to make a more thoughtful and thorough assessment of fraud risk and develop appropriate audit responses. Finally, these proposed standards reflect an effort to reduce unnecessary differences with the risk assessment standards of other standard setters. The proposed standards were issued again on Tuesday for a 120-day comment period. Comments are due on February 18th of 2009. The next item, engagement quality review. On February 26th of this year, the board proposed a new auditing standard entitled Engagement Quality Review, which would supersede the interim concurring partner review requirement. Section 103 of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act requires the board to adopt in its auditing standards a requirement for a concurring or second partner review and approval of each audit report and concurring approval in its issuance. We commonly refer to the concurring or second partner review as the engagement quality review because we believe this term is more reflective of the objective of this review. The board received 38 comment letters on this proposal, most of which came from the auditing profession and issuers. Many of the letters included alternatives to the proposed requirements in this standard. The staff is in the process of evaluating these comments In response to these comments, the staff plans to make a recommendation to the board in the next few months. The next item, the last item on this slide, has to do with audit practice alert number 2 on December 10th, 2007. The staff issued this alert entitled Matters Relating to Auditing Fair Value Measurements of Financial Instruments and the Use of Specialists. This alert was issued in response to developments in the credit markets and the difficulties of determining fair values when direct observation of prices in an active market are not available. The alert reminds auditors of their responsibilities for auditing fair value measurements of financial instruments and when using the work of specialists under the existing standards of the PCAOB. The alert focuses on specific matters that are likely to increase audit risk related to the fair value of financial instruments in a rapidly changing economic environment. The alert remains relevant to issues being raised about fair value measurements in the current economic environment. Next, on January 29th of this year, the board adopted auditing standard number 6, evaluating consistency of financial statements and amendments to its interim standards that supersede the interim standard AU section 420, consistency of application of generally accepted accounting principles. Auditing standard number 6 and the related amendments also removed the hierarchy of generally accepted accounting principles from the interim auditing standards. The board adopted the auditing standard in response to the Financial Accounting Standards Board issuing Statement 154, Auditing Accounting Changes and Error Corrections, and Statement 162, the Hierarchy of Generally Accepted Accounting Principles. On September 16th, the SEC approved Auditing Standard Number 6. This standard and the conforming amendments are effective 60 days after SEC approval. Thus, this standard becomes effective on November 15th of 2008. The next item and last item on the slide has to do with the Ethics and Independence Rule 3526 and an amendment to our Rule 3523. On April 22nd of this year, the board adopted an Ethics and Independence Rule, Rule 3526, communication with audit committees concerning independence. This was adopted to enhance the communication between the auditor and the audit committee by requiring the auditor prior to accepting an initial engagement under the standards of the PCAOB to describe in writing to the audit committee all relationships between the auditor and any affiliates of the auditor and the potential client or persons in a financial reporting oversight role at the potential audit client that may reasonably be thought to bear on independence. Rule 3526 supersedes the board's interim standards, the Independent Standards Board's standard number 1, entitled Independence Discussions with Audit Committees, and also 2 related interpretations. The board also adopted an amendment to Rule 3523, Tax Services for Persons in Financial Reporting Oversight Roles. The amended 3523 does not prohibit tax services provided during the portion of the audit period that precedes the beginning of the professional engagement period. This amendment to Rule 3523 became effective on August 22nd of 2008, the date the SEC approved both the amendment and Rule 3526. The Rule 3526 became effective on September 30th. In addition to standard setting projects, it's also important to mention that there are a variety of other activities in which the staff of the Office of the Chief Auditor is involved throughout the year. For instance, the Office of the Chief Auditor contributes substantial amounts of time in order to assist the PCAOB's other divisions and offices by, among other things, advising and consulting on projects and activities, reviewing inspection reports and enforcement recommendations, and responding to inquiries from outside parties. The Office of the Chief Auditor devotes time as an observer in various activities of the Financial Accounting Standards Board, as well as in various international standard-setting activities. The office also meets regularly with representatives from the U.S. Government Accountability Office and the U.S. Auditing Standards Board to discuss respective standard-setting activities. The office also has been involved in monitoring the SEC and Treasury advisory committees. And finally, the office is involved in participating at various educational programs, including the PCAOB's forums on auditing in the small business environment. Now I'd like to turn the next part of our discussion before we have the open discussion over to Jennifer Rand, who will outline our current standard setting priorities.
Thank you, Greg. So next I'd like to outline our current priorities. The items on this next slide, or the slide that's up here right now, include a listing of current priorities, which are matters we expect to give significant attention to during the next 12 months, and many of these will indicate timing with respect to our proposed activities. First is completing proposed standards. As Greg just mentioned, this year we proposed two new standards, or actually more than that, one on engagement quality review and then seven proposed standards related to risk assessment. These projects obviously will remain a priority for us, and we intend to complete engagement quality review in 2009. We similarly intend to complete the risk assessment standards in 2009, although the timing is subject to the comments we receive from exposure. As Greg mentioned, that went out for a 100-day comment period. It is a significant effort for us, and we will certainly be carefully evaluating the comments we receive. The next group relates to our active standards projects, and these are projects that the staff is currently devoting significant time to. First is related to fair value and specialists. As I just mentioned, we have devoted significant time in evaluating the current auditing standards related to fair value and specialists. We are considering both standards contemporaneously because specialists are increasingly used by both auditors and management with respect to fair value measurements. The staff has been following the developments in the current credit crisis and how the current economic environment may affect the development of new auditing standards. As it relates to fair value, this project encompasses updating the existing standards on auditing accounting estimates, auditing fair value measurements, and auditing derivatives and other financial instruments. These are three separate standards under the board's interim standards. Then in the specialist project, we are evaluating the requirements regarding the auditor's use of specialists in instances where a company engages a specialist or employs a specialist and the auditor uses that specialist work as evidential matter. And we're also looking at the situation where the auditor engages a specialist him or herself and uses that specialist in connection with the audit. The fair value and specialist project is a very high priority for us, and the staff anticipates issuing a concept release for public comment, and our goal is by the end of 2008. With respect to confirmations, we are reevaluating the auditor's use of confirmations to corroborate a company's account balances and transactions with third parties. The existing standards do not address all areas for which direct confirmation with third parties may be preferable to applying other audit procedures and certain practice issues, such as when management requests the auditors not to confirm and authenticating confirmation responses received electronically. This project is also considering fraud risk as it relates to confirmations. The staff has devoted significant time to this project in the last several months and anticipates that a proposed standard will be issued for public comment in early 2009. Regarding related parties, we are reevaluating the auditor's obligation for the identification and evaluation of related parties and related party transactions, as well as fraud risk factors, and considering what direction is needed to help auditors satisfy that obligation. The staff has devoted significant time to this project in the last several months and anticipates that a proposed standard will be issued for public comment in 2009. Regarding the guidance for auditors of smaller companies related to auditing standard number 5, last year on October 17, 2008, the PCAOB published for public comment staff guidance on auditing internal control over financial reporting for smaller companies. The comment period provided an opportunity for further improve that guidance. The staff has considered the comments received together with information we've received this year from our inspections group on observations of auditor implementation of auditing standard number 5. The staff plans to finalize this guidance by the end of the year. regarding the action plan for review of interim standards. Last year, you may recall, we mentioned that the staff began formulating some preliminary views with respect to the board's interim standards. As you are aware, shortly after the board's inception, the board adopted the existing standards of the AICPA on an initial transitional basis and called them our interim standards and indicated that a schedule and procedure for the review of those interim standards would be established. In fulfilling the board's objective, we plan to develop a concept release to obtain public comment and feedback regarding the board's review of the interim standards. We may also seek additional advice from the Standing Advisory Group on this subject next year. We anticipate issuing a concept release in early 2009. Then as it relates to our standing consider priorities in general, and it's not on here in our slide, but it's worthy of mentioning, that's a consideration of work of other standard setters. In connection with our standard setting projects, we plan to consider the work of other standard setters as we work on individual projects. For instance, we will consider the IAASB standards on fair value, specialist confirmations, and related parties. We will also consider relevant work of other standard setters and regulators. For instance, as part of developing the proposed risk assessment standards, among other things, we made an effort to reduce unnecessary differences with other standard setters. We are seeking feedback on that approach in the risk assessment project, but regardless of our approach in writing standards, we will continue to evaluate relevant work of other parties. Next, I'd like to turn to other matters that do affect our priorities, and these are not on our list, but they're worthy of being highlighted because they're issues we're certainly monitoring and giving attention to. The first relates to federal advisory committees. As you're aware, there were two federal advisory committees which focused on the accounting and auditing profession in 2007 and 2008. The SEC established the Advisory Committee on Improvements to Financial Reporting, known as the CIFER Committee, to provide advice to the SEC on the U.S. financial reporting system with the goal of reducing unnecessary complexity and making information more useful and understandable for investors. The U.S. Department of the Treasury established the Advisory Committee on the Auditing Profession, known as the Treasury Advisory Committee, to provide advice and recommendations to the Department of the Treasury on the sustainability of a strong and vibrant public company accounting profession. While a few recommendations of the CIFER Committee involved the PCAOB, the Treasury Advisory Committee made a number of recommendations related to the PCAOB. The CIFER Committee issued its final report on August 1st of this year, and the Treasury Committee issued its final report on October 6th of 2008. Both reports outline recommendations to the SEC, the FASB, and the PCAOB. Several of the recommendations relate directly to standard setting, and at the February 2008 SAG meeting, the SAG discussed the CIFER recommendation relating to professional judgment, and during this meeting, the SAG has discussed two of the Treasury Advisory Committee recommendations related to signing the auditor's report and the feasibility of developing audit quality indicators. At this time, the board is in the process of evaluating the recommendations from these two federal advisory committees related to the PCAOB. Next involves changing accounting standards. The staff works closely with and monitors FASB projects related to accounting standards because changes in accounting standards may affect the board's auditing standards. For example, earlier this month, the FASB issued exposure drafts for two proposed accounting standards, one related to going concern and the other related to subsequent events. The Office of the Chief Auditor is currently evaluating these exposure drafts and considering whether the board's auditing standards will need to be amended in light of the proposed accounting standards. The staff is also monitoring the FASB developments related to the Accounting for Loss Contingencies project. Then finally, Securities and Exchange Commission actions. The staff is also monitoring two SEC projects, one related to International Financial Reporting Standards, IFRS, and the other relating to Extensible Business Reporting Language, XBRL. Specifically, the staff is monitoring the SEC's project on potentially allowing U.S. issuers to prepare financial statements in accordance with IFRS. The staff is evaluating what type of effect the SEC's project will have on the board's interim auditing standards. Additionally, in May 2008, The SEC issued for public comment a proposed rule on mandating the use of XBRL-based filing program interactive data to improve financial reporting. The proposal does not require any form of auditor assurance in XBRL-submitted documents, but it did seek public comment on whether auditors should be required to provide that type of attestation. The staff is monitoring the SEC's activities and will revisit the PCAOB staff questions and issues that we issued a few years ago in May 2005, and those staff questions and answers addressed attest engagements regarding XBRL information furnished under the XBRL Voluntary Financial Reporting Program on the EDGAR system. So we will evaluate our guidance, interact with the SEC under directions they'll be taken, and determine if any changes are necessary once the SEC does finalize its rule. Finally, in summary, these topics represent our view of standard setting priorities as of today. The final set of priorities is determined based on the results of the PCAOB's oversight of registered public accounting firms, monitoring of the environment, and consultation with the board standing advisory group, among other factors. The standard setting process includes, among other things, consideration of the results from the board's oversight activities, the work of other standard setters, advice from the SAG, research, and solicitation of public comments. The board and its staff carefully consider the priority level of each potential standard setting project and allocate staff and board resources accordingly. Obviously, changes such as in the economic climate, as well as any new legislative initiatives, could cause the board to adjust its priorities over the year. With that as the backdrop of the proposed standard setting priorities, we would now open up the floor for your input and advice, reactions to what we've presented to you this afternoon. Cindy Richson.
Thank you. I have a question and a comment, I guess. My first question is, in January of 2007, PCAOB issued a report on the aspects of the board's interim auditing standards that address the auditor's responsibility with respect to fraud, principally AU Section 316, and that in the report the board did not change or propose to change any existing standard, nor is the report meant to provide a new interpretation of any aspect of existing standards, and that this report talked about certain observations made in the course of board inspections. And yesterday in our quality discussion breakout sessions, which was a great session, the topic arose that under, I believe it's Sarbanes-Oxley, a certain part of the, which we've talked about, of the inspection findings have to remain confidential because the audit firms have a year to cure, et cetera. And so we were, one thing to consider, I guess, is, especially in light of a new administration coming in November at the election, is perhaps the PCAOB, if that information that now is required legally to be confidential would be helpful in identifying quality drivers or otherwise be useful to at least seek additional flexibility legislatively to give PCAOB the authority that they need to make useful, good usefulness of that information on a broader scale than I'm sure currently are doing behind the scenes. So my question then is, at the SAG meeting in June of 2004, we had talked about SAS 99 on financial fraud, and then you guys did the briefing paper in September of 2004. So my question is, in all the priorities and standard setting going forward for the next year, and I know you mentioned just a few minutes ago about how fraud you were looking at in terms of confirmations and another issue, is there any thoughts that the standard should be looked at again, or what's the thinking on that topic? Thank you.
I think you had two observations in there. The first that I heard, I think, and I just want to clarify, was related to the inspection reports and Sarbanes-Oxley itself. And I think I heard your recommendation is it would be nice if the Part 2 findings or the non-public could be made public. Perhaps there are legislative change, with the change in the government. Is that correct? Kind of just...
Yes, or at least give PCAOB more authority to use that information in a more public way than my understanding is that currently you're restricted by Sarbanes-Oxley from doing that.
Right, we are. Okay. The second related to consideration of fraud and a few just a few comments with respect to that. Certainly, you made reference to the inspection report or observation that was issued in January 2007 regarding firms' implementation of AU 316 or SAS 99, which is regarding fraud. One thing we just did recently, part of those observations related to auditors' assessment of risk and how they are responding to that fraud risk factors. And one thing we did in our risk assessment standards was incorporate much of that direction into the risk assessment process because we saw that there would be room for improvement where auditors were kind of going through that thought process looking for risk on a mechanical basis, and we think we're very hopeful that integrating that direction into risk assessment and the auditor's overall focus should help. Second, I made reference to the Treasury Advisory Committee, and there was a recommendation that wasn't mentioned, but that relates to the PCAOB revisiting the auditors or the audit report and how the responsibility for fraud is outlined in that, plus the overall responsibility. So I mentioned that the PCAOB is in the process of evaluating that. We did bring forth for this meeting two topics. That one, based on the timing of the report, is significant. We did not have time to prepare for that discussion if we wanted to do so. But it's certainly something, as I mentioned, fraud and other projects that we have with confirmations related parties. So we're certainly mindful of it, and we will have ongoing focus, particularly in light of considering the recommendations from the Treasury. Ernie Ball.
Thank you. I said I have about 4 points that I'd like to make. The risk assessment proposal went out Tuesday. We have, being as how we've been here, we haven't had a whole heck of a lot of time to go through it. I did go through it briefly, and I was surprised, somewhat astounded, by something that I found not there. We have a very detailed comparison to the international accounting or auditing standards, but the AICPA standards, which have been effective for a year and which have been implemented by virtually all firms, are hardly mentioned at all. It would be really good if we knew where they were the same and where they were different. First point. Second point, you have a project to review the interim auditing standards. I would suggest that you closely monitor and maybe even participate in the Auditing Standards Board's Clarity and Convergence Project, because they're going through every one of those standards, and they're going to change them. They're going to rewrite them. The participation of this group would be very beneficial to everybody involved. One of the recommendations from the Federal Advisory Committee is actually something that I suggested last year at this meeting. That is a codification of the independence rules. Independence rules are quite complicated. They're in various places. If we could bring them together, that would be a real benefit to the profession. And particularly, if we could get our friends from the GAO and the DOL to participate in the same project, that would be really good. Last point. I've been involved with standard setting bodies for over 20 years now. I was intrigued with the discussion of SOP 94-6 yesterday. I was one of the authors of that standard. In all of my previous experience, standard setting has been done in the open, in the sunshine. I think this process could benefit from, you know, performing in the same manner. I think it would be very beneficial if you got input as you are developing standards, as opposed to only after they are developed. Thank you.
Thank you. Just a couple remarks. Ernie, you mentioned the proposed risk assessment standards and just the comments you made. I would encourage you to certainly issue a public comment letter to us, you know, to express those views, because I'm just not in a position, because it is an open comment period, to really talk beyond that. The codification of the independence roles is certainly it's one of the recommendations that's kind of in the overview. And then transparency, we are a relatively new standard setter, and I certainly believe that our board is thinking of ways, you know, to enhance transparency further. But, you know, appreciate your comments on that. So let's see who's next. Joe Carcello.
Yeah, a couple of points. At the comparable meeting last year, I believe I raised the point, and I think some others may have raised it as well, that you have access to information that your counterparts at the ASB and the IAASB don't, and that's the inspection reports. And I encouraged you, as well as others, I believe, to really work at mapping the deficiencies that you've identified via the inspections into the standards where applicable, and to analyze whether those deficiencies result from weaknesses in the standards or weaknesses in performance relating to the standards. You didn't discuss whether you're doing that. I still think that's something that's well worth doing, because you're taking advantage of unique information that only you have. The second point would be, and I understand that there are extenuating circumstances with AS2 and AS5 and so forth, without going into all the extenuating circumstances. But I think most people would view the output of standards over the last 5 years as modest. And so one of the things that I think you should consider doing is really doing a pretty detailed analysis of whether your staffing is sufficient for the task. And when the Auditing Standards Board did this, I believe there were about 15 members on the ASB, but that's misleading, because all of those 15 people had two or three dedicated staff assigned to them. So there was really probably 45 or 60 people, and if needed, probably more than that. And your staffing is pretty modest. There have been alternatives discussed as to what you could do. One alternative that has been discussed is you don't avail yourself of other resources that might be available to you, either on a gratis basis or for on a fee for hire basis. And one of the possibilities, obviously, would be to involve people in the profession more in the process. Now, I know the concern with that is Sarbanes-Oxley gives you the opportunity to do this, but if you relied more on people who are in the profession, they certainly have the expertise. The concern is, would they write standards that are self-serving? But I think you can leverage your staff in evaluating that. And you can look at something that they might work on, and you say, no, this is just covering your backside. This is no good for the public interest. But they have the ability. I believe they have the willingness. And with appropriate oversights and checks and balances, you probably could really leverage your existing resources and be a lot more productive. So just something to consider.
Thank you, Joe. Lynn Turner.
Let me first echo a couple of points Ernie made. I, too, when the risk management standard came out, was looking through it and looking for that comparison with the existing standards and all. And I think it would be most helpful, especially if for this group, you could send us a red line type comparison between what's in the proposal versus what's in existing standards, U.S. standards, and international, so we could get a flavor for that, so we could write a meaningful comment letter back to you. And I think that would be most helpful. Second thing on transparency, I remember when twice I was following the Auditing Standards Board from the SEC perspective. I thought the ASB did a phenomenally good job in their public meetings and actually talking about the standards in the public meetings and why they were going where they were, rather than just go to a meeting and vote and then vote again once they got to a final standard. And I think it would behoove this board to adopt the same type of transparency that the Auditing Standards Board and the profession has used in their standard setting in the past, because the transparency you got is a huge step down from what's been there in the past, and I think it well serves investors. As far as priorities go, I would hope that the Treasury Committee recommendations will be taken up. You talked about the quality factors and auditor signature report, but the biggest item there, which is fraud, which gets into both auditor's report on fraud, as well as the fraud center, were hardly mentioned here. And I would certainly hope that that doesn't mean that you're not looking at doing those, and would put those at the very top. In fact, when I go back to what investors told you 5 years ago they'd like you to look at, one was the fraud standard, still haven't done that. One was getting into the auditor's report, still haven't done that. And in light of the current economic situation, there's a recommendation in there about annual reports so people can actually monitor and understand the financial stability of these firms given the economic situation that we have. And I think it would behoove you to put those on the budget or on the budget and in the priority. And in that regards, I have one question for the board members, and that is, does the board anticipate including in its budget for this next year money to do a fraud center as the Treasury Committee recommended?
Budget is still a work in progress, that is a consideration, Lynn.
Finn Coleman.
But let me say, and as you know, Lynn, with respect to the fraud center, we were, as a result of the discussion that happened in the Treasury report, you may recall there was a lot of discussion about where it should be housed, and when the recommendation came out that it should be housed with the PCAOB, I made the point, and I think others did, that we were not looking for new opportunities or new jurisdiction, but we did not oppose that. So I think implicit in that is that we're taking that into consideration.
Thank you, Mark. Ben Coleman.
Yeah, I guess, and everybody's been teasing about agreeing with you, Lynn. I was just pleased with what you just talked about around the standard-setting process. I mean, it is a different process, and I would also encourage the board to really think about the process. There are, whether it be the Auditing Standards Board process, or quite frankly, there's other processes in the standard setting that has more transparency in it than this one. And I think what happened during the quality review standard is an excellent example of how that process can be improved. And then secondly, I just have an overarching question that I've still not been able to, when it comes to the standard setting, fully understand. And I just, as a SAG member or an interested party, would really like to understand at some point in time, and I think you referenced it a little bit, Jennifer, but the guiding principles. What are the guiding principles that set the priorities? Okay, is one of those guiding principles, of how you're going to set the priorities, or is it, say, reactionary or judgments? Some of which was Joe's talking about is a priority with respect to what you learn, and I mean, it's just not understandable to me. I've never really been able to figure it out. Is a priority convergence? In other words, is that an overarching principle or not? Because I think it should be. And to the extent there's differences, well, then fine, there's differences. We explain why they are. You support why there's a difference, and we all move forward. And then lastly, is an overarching principle cost-benefit? You know, to ensure that when we're putting something in place, we understand the ramifications of it. And I just think if we had some type of framework, it'd be really helpful as a, you know, because here we're just setting events that are happening here, and I'd like to understand what drives those events.
I feel like that deserves some type of reaction, although we have not published any driving principles, although in our standard-setting projects we've made reference to a variety of different factors, such as, you know, Sarbanes-Oxley Act mandating certain things or observations from inspections. A significant input for us has been input and advice from the Standing Advisory Group, and as Greg mentioned when he talked about our list of projects that, you know, many of them were on the list last year and have carried forward as important topics that came from discussions with the SAG. So they remain in our list, and I outlined our timing with respect to moving forward and issuing either a concept release or proposed standards or finalizing those projects. So there's a, just, you know, in my, while we haven't published any guiding principles, there's a lot of factors such as what's going on in the environment, legislative activities. You know, there may be significant developments by other standard setters that we think warrant attention and move forward. Certainly the Treasury Advisory Committee is one factor that influences our standing setting activities. So there's a lot of various principles. And you talked about convergence and in risk assessment, you know, we discussed looking at other standard setters and differences, some of the differences are the reasons we made differences and looking for public comment on that. So your comments are good ones and just wanted to provide you with some initial observations. Kurt Schott.
Thank you, Jennifer. Just a quick question. Have you discussed, and would it be appropriate, given the rather new and important component to financial condition that a number of firms are going to be facing, to coordinate with FASB and the SEC for some specific discussion in the financial reports and audit attention to the level of and the reliance upon the government credit assistance program?
I'm looking to you, Mark, and you're looking to me. Do you
want to let's give that some thought. I think is the right answer to that. I don't know that we have an answer right off the top of our head.
That's a good comment.
Kurt, was there anything in particular you were focused on with respect to that program and anything you were thinking about initially?
Well, I think first and foremost, the obvious question is, what does it do to the going concern analysis?
That was what I was thinking about initially, was the going concern, but I didn't know if there's, you know, anything else beyond that. Okay.
Dick Dietrich.
Thank you. Last weekend, I was reading the Advisory Committee on the Auditing Professions report, and I learned that there's an elephant in the room. So I don't know if you all had a chance to read that letter, but here's the way I interpret this. Separation of duties is an important thing, and one of the most important structural changes we made in corporate governance is to impose independent audit committees that would have the responsibility of overseeing the relationship between the auditor and the company on behalf of the shareholders. During our breakout session yesterday, I think there were questions raised about the extent to which the audit committee had common cause with the investors generally, and that one could not presuppose that that was always working well. And if we ask the question, who oversees the work of the audit committee? We certainly have the PCAOB to oversee the work of the auditors. We have the auditors to oversee the work of management with respect to financial reporting. But who oversees that other entity, the audit committee? While this may appear to be outside the purview of the PCAOB, it strikes me as a very important question on maintaining the integrity of the financial reporting process. I don't know if that's the elephant in the room or not, but it's the one that I have heard increasingly frequently mentioned by people in public accounting. And the story often goes something like this. The audit committee defers to management to work directly with the auditor to determine the scope of the audit, where audits will be conducted, the number of hours that will be incorporated into the audit. And once they have resolved that, they take it to the audit committee, and the audit committee reviews the work and then makes a determination. The thing that concerns me about that process is that we have a breakdown, I fear, in the separation of duties that was contemplated in constructing independent audit committees. There are potentially remedies that the PCAOB could undertake to address this that might help to reinvigorate the separation of duties that I think was contemplated in Sarbanes-Oxley, and I would suggest that the board give consideration to doing so. Thank you.
Just as a follow-up, do you have any particular remedies in mind that we could undertake?
Oh, I have the remedies of an academic, which may or may not be at all practical. But one remedy, for example, would be if we take independence seriously, then it would seem to me that management should have no conversations with an auditor having to do with the scope of the audit. But that should be a decision that's made by the audit committee and not by management. Now, I don't mean to malign the integrity of management, who may be working in the best interest of shareholders too, but we have to contemplate in the structure that we can't presume that that will happen. So one of the things that potentially one could say is there should not be conversations like that between management and the auditor directly on the scope of the audit or other activities related to the work of the auditor. Certainly there has to be lots of conversations going back and forth about specific matters during the conduct of the audit. But what one could say is, if there were conversations, and let me just pose one, if I were a nefarious CFO and I didn't want my auditor to be really doing things that would actually cause him to find the places in the financial statements where I have misstated material numbers. So I could say, look, there's no reason for you to make a trip to the division that happens to be in a foreign country. It's very expensive for you to do that. We want to keep down audit fees, and I know that that's where the problems are, so I don't want you down there. Now, I'm not going to say that last part of the phrase, but that's what's in my head. And so the question is, should we allow those kinds of conversations to take place? Well, all you'd have to say is it would be a violation of auditor independence if those conversations took place. The way to cure the violation by the auditor would be to raise his hand and send immediately a letter to the audit committee and potentially file an 8K. Again, these are the thoughts of an academic. But you could say something like, at least inform the audit committee. Beyond that, there's not a strong enough structure. I mean, we're left to the investor community to try to monitor the activities of the audit committee. That's the weakest link that I think we have right now in the current structure. And it may be related, and I apologize, I'm not sure, but it may be related to this elephant in the room. To the extent that it's still management who's determining how much to pay the auditor, or one of the other examples I heard was an audit partner who told me that they had expended 12,000 hours on 13,000 hours on an audit last year, and the CFO said, get it down to 12,000 or we're going to recommend that we go out for bids. That strikes me as back in the situation where the audit committee was not really running things again. Now, it's possible that the audit committee chair could have said, no, we want to still scope the audit at 13,000 hours. But it's also possible that the audit committee chair would say, oh, I'm listening to you very carefully, dear CFO. And so turn to the audit partner and say, so what's wrong with 12,000 hours? That would put the partner, I think, in a very difficult position. And that's maybe something that the board could consider, how those kinds of communications might work appropriately and what might be inappropriate, and determine whether or not they could construct a mechanism that would preclude those kinds of inappropriate, or what I perceive to be inappropriate, communications that serve only to degrade the quality of the audit.
Thank you. I'd be interested, kind of like I did in the last round, if there's kind of views or observations in connection with that comment. And I see we've got two going up right now. So because I asked for any immediate response, looks like I'll take the line down there. Vin Coleman was, I think, first.
I like how you talk about the academic. I would just make one point. Do I think that there could be improvement in perhaps the communication, education of audit committees and doing their roles? Sure. But the notion to say that there should be no communication with management and during your scoping and risk assessment, I would tell you that process, if it's done right by all of the stakeholders, actually can be valuable if the audit committee is doing what they're doing. So the notion to say we'll do it without the without management's assistance, that there can be very healthy tension in those discussions about having an effective and an efficient, you know, risk assessment and audit plan. As long as your point's well taken, that there's the appropriate oversight of that as part of the process. But I wouldn't want to say it's inappropriate to have a conversation with management.
Yeah, and
I think that's a little...
No,
I'm not sure I would recommend that.
I didn't
that.
State that carefully enough, Ben. I think a conversation like that in the presence of the audit committee is fine. It's a question of whether those conversations can occur outside of the presence of the audit committee. Certainly in the presence of the audit committee, not a problem from my perspective.
Well, you don't want to solve this, but there's a great example to the extent that there was that notion that then, by definition, you have a disagreement with management. You should be having that communication with the audit committee on today's standards. So there's a mechanism today for that.
Galen Hansen.
Yeah, I was talking to Dick about this at one of the prior breaks, and I do agree with some of those perceptions, although I do also agree with Vince's observation. I think management is an important part of the inputs in the developing of the scope, but they shouldn't be part of the outputs, and it may be worth some sort of, you know, what is inappropriate communications with management, whenever you get into scope limitations. I mean, maybe it's not a problem with the Fortune 500, but at my level and the firms that I'm working with, you know, a lot of times the focus of these audit committees, and particularly the CFOs, the CEOs, some of them have spent a good deal of time with audit firms before they became the controller or the CFO, and one thing that they do know how to control is audit fees. They may not understand the operations of the company yet, but in a new role especially, that's where a lot of the focus is how to control the audit fee. And I think that it is something that really has no place, and I think most of us would agree with that.
Joe Carcello.
Well, Dick and I have talked about this this issue before, so I don't know if the specifics of what he recommends are the best way forward, and he was very modest in how he presented it, but I do think he's identified a real problem, and one of the things that concerned me about Sarbanes when it was written is there's tremendous amount of oversight of auditors, a huge amount, and much more oversight and liability for senior management, but so much of the law really hinges on the audit committee doing their job well. And I think some of them do, and probably more than we would like don't. And so although that's not directly your mandate, there's probably an indirect effect through your standards on auditors, so I think you should probably be thinking about that. The other issue I would raise is just, I think, in general, again, I don't know if it's Tom's group or George's group or other groups within the board, is to be looking at what I'll call indirect effects of other behavior in the markets. Without going into too much in the way of specifics, there's some evidence to suggest that portion of non-accelerated filers are not including the 404A report, even though they're required to. And if the SEC ever expands the 404B certification to those filers, and if they do it in a timely manner, I think, you know, a second order effect would be how could you possibly have effective internal control over financial reporting if you didn't even include the report in the first place, even if you filed it late the fact that you didn't know or you ignored the responsibility to do it would seem to me to be de facto proof that you don't have effective internal control over financial reporting. And I would look at the auditor opinions on those. And if you get auditor opinions, if 404B is extended, that say there is effective internal control over financial reporting, that would really trouble me a lot about what the auditors are doing. So it's those examples of second and third order effects that I think as regulators are good things to be thinking about and looking for.
Thank you, Joe. Chuck Noski, did you have a comment in response to Dick Dietrich?
I did, thank you. Dick, I'm sure you're concerned that when the audit committee abdicates their responsibility to management, that you have a problem. And I'm not sure I've got a good answer for you, and I don't know that you want to set up a PCAOB for audit committees. I don't know who would want to be on that board. I do think, though, that we've had some experience now for a few years on the definition of an audit committee financial expert. And if you recall, in the design of that, it started out as a relatively narrow definition with lots of functional and professional experience, and then it got broadened out to anybody who ever supervised a chief financial officer, and then some. So it may be time to revisit that definition as a way of strengthening the audit committee and at least helping them have a better understanding of what it is they're supposed to be doing. I agree with the earlier comments. I would be reluctant to keep management out of the audit scope and audit risk discussions, but again, it's got to be a balanced dialogue among management, the audit committee, and the auditor, with a heavy dose, at least in my experience, of executive sessions between the audit committee and the auditor about audit risk and audit scope. Rather than prescribing the communications between management and the auditor, and I think Mark Olson heard me say this over 2 years ago, I think that the communications between auditors and audit committees, as provided for in the auditing standards, is poor and not particularly helpful to the charter of the audit committee or the obligations that we have on those committees. So I would encourage, as you think about priorities, Jennifer, I would encourage you to look at the communications between audit committees and auditors. I think the written communications are poor at best. I think many auditors are confused, sometimes by management, sometimes by their inexperience, as to what their obligations are with respect to the audit committee. And I encourage my auditors on the audit committees I serve on to read the audit committee charter and ask themselves what they're doing to help the audit committee completely and achieve all of the objectives in that audit committee charter in a very professional way. Thanks.
Thank you, Chuck. Now I think I'm back on track, and I thank you for the additional feedback or reaction in connection with Dick Dietrich's comment. That was helpful. So next is Bob Tarola.
Thanks, Jennifer. I put my tent card up for another reason, but I want to weigh in and echo what Chuck just said about more robust, more relevant communications with audit committees. It is too boilerplate, in my opinion. But the reason I put my tent card up was because I think there's an issue that I feel as an issuer, investors are asking for more information of us, either directly or through the channels of the SEC or other bodies, more information, more often, more granular, often not financial in nature, key performance indicators and the like, and definitely in the near term in electronic format. So that issuer information is being disseminated in the marketplace through means other than the typical paper full financial statement. And auditor association involvement, assurance on that information, I think would be an important factor in the marketplace. I know the AICPA is looking at that to some degree, but I think the PCAOB also ought to have it on its agenda to examine, perhaps not as a number one priority, but at least on the list.
I'd like to ask you a follow-up question. You talked about just the current communications are poor, too boilerplate, or I think you might have said that. Just anything in particular or anything else you might, you know, be looking for that would be helpful from the issue, you know, from that perspective?
As an audit committee member?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think Chuck had it right on. If the auditing firm focused on helping the committee fulfill its charter obligations, I also think that's an obligation of management, frankly. But moreover, a qualitative commentary about factors affecting the audit, factors affecting the company, factors affecting all the things that go into determining whether or not financial statements are fairly presented and future risk is understood.
Thank you. John Kellis.
Thank you. If I can remember what I was going to say, because it seems so long ago that I put the card up. But first of all, a lot of what is in these slides looks familiar, and to that extent, it is always good that standard setters seem to have very similar priorities, and I think in the meetings of national standard setters, which you and I attend, it's clear that there are common issues and common themes, and therefore it's no surprise as to which issues are here. We have, as you know, recently or will soon have completed the revision of all our standards, and with that in mind, we had a consultation on what we should be doing after that, and there was generally a common consensus that we probably have done enough on the straightforward standard side, with the possible exception, one of the standards that was raised was whether internal audit practice had perhaps gone ahead of current auditing standards, and maybe that should be looked at again, and we are going to do that. You mentioned the audit report. That came through as a theme that we ought to be looking at. The audit report excites comments from investors and others, including people within the profession, as to whether it is in reality the best advertisement for the work that auditors do. And so we have it in mind to look at that. We are not looking at introducing any new standards within the next 2 years, but that will give us an opportunity to do some research into audit reports, for example, and to see what people want out of them, and whether what people want out of them is something that auditors can deliver. We're also going to use this time to look at issues of audit quality that have been discussed here, and following on from the UK work. We think there is work to be done there, and you could imagine that that might lead to something that is directed as much at audit committees as at auditors themselves. We are quite keen to develop a process, and here you have the advantage on us, of seeing how effective standards have been maybe 2 years after their issue in achieving the objectives that we had for them. And here I think the inspection process is enormously helpful. And I think on an international basis there's a challenge in trying to get the results of inspections throughout the world. But I think we need to find a means of doing that. So we will be certainly looking at that over the next couple of years. Also, cost-benefit, as Vin Coleman raised, the whole question of impact assessments is something that we need to resolve, again, with legislators adopting standards in certain jurisdictions, cost-benefit considerations and impact assessments become that bit more important. So I think we've got quite a lot that will be going on that is sort of parallel with standard development, but aimed at improving quality of audits over the next 2 years or so. But I think that as this is my last meeting, I might just raise the question of convergence, and again, Bing Coleman has referred to this. I haven't had a chance to look at your new suite of 7 exposure drafts, but I'm certainly very pleased that you have a comparison or some information about differences with international standards. And I think I believe very strongly that convergence is important, and I think it is important for audit quality. The stability of the US markets is not solely dependent on the audit work conducted within the boundaries of the United States, but also, of course, the audit work conducted outside, first of all on subsidiaries of US enterprises, but also on the financial statements of foreign registrants. And it seems to me self-evident that if you had an auditor in another jurisdiction seeking to meet your standards, then for that auditor to know precisely what is the difference between your standards and the standards that that auditor would normally apply is going to be helpful to the extent that people accept that standards are necessary for audit quality. And therefore, I think you have the review of interim standards, for example, on your program, and I think I would like to think that perhaps in conjunction with ourselves and other national standard setters, that you do put a significant premium on achieving convergence, because I do believe that it will, in the long run, benefit the users of financial statements, who are, after all, the beneficiaries of auditing standards.
Okay. Well, John, certainly in our risk assessment proposal, there is an appendix which outlines the notable differences with the ISAs. And certainly one in our jurisdiction is the audit of internal control over financial reporting, which, you know, obviously is a significant audit effort as well, which internationally that does not exist. So that certainly kind of is a common theme as far as notable differences with the standards. But you know, we are certainly in public comment and, you know, feedback on what we've done in the risk assessment standards, and you know, thank you for your comments on that. Let's see, Lynn Turner.
Just a couple points. I too would like to echo what Chuck had said earlier about the audit committees and the communication. For those who around the table, there were a number of them that worked on the old Blue Ribbon panel report on audit committees, and it was built on the notion of a three-legged stool, which had really as people working together, the auditor and the audit committee, and the management team, the CFO. And I do think you got to have all three working together, and you can't be excluding one totally to the exclusion of the other, or you just have a breakdown in the process. And Chuck mentioned, and so did Bob, the audit communication and the real need to improve that. And I think very much so along the lines of what Chuck said, picking up the audit committee charter and saying, how can you help me do this, is excellent. But as I recall, the last 2 years, in the same meeting up on the slide, we've had auditor communication as one of the projects that was going to be worked on. And certainly the Auditing Standards Board has been doing that, and I think has recently put something out on that, and yet we still haven't seen anything forthcoming out of this group. And now this year I don't see it up on the list. And so is that been dropped from the list of priorities? Is that gone now, or is it still a work in process? And if we dropped it, why did it get dropped and not get done? Because I think that is an important project, especially in light of what the ASB does. And it seems like the ASB constantly is ahead of this group, and this group is constantly behind the curve with respect to the work that the ASB is doing. And I constantly hear people say, will you guys ever be able to catch up to them and get ahead of the curve rather than be behind the profession all the time, which is a valid concern. And so I think on this one, the question comes, what happened with the auditor communication project, and has it just gone defunct now?
In response to your question on that, Lynn, we've had some draft. We have a draft standard and some recommendations to the board, and we've had some other projects to get in front of it. But if you think it's, and if other members of the SAG think it's that important, then we can certainly reconsider and move that back up to where, you know, back on the schedule.
It just seems, you know, again, year and year and year, we see these same slides, and I think I make the same comment about the last 3 years now. We see projects go on, you spend time on the projects, and then they disappear. If you spend all the time and all the money and budget on a project to get to a draft stage, and now all of a sudden it's just put on the backside, it raises the question of, are we really being effective as an organization in getting things out and really prioritized and focused? And I do think this is an important thing. Would I make it top? Probably not. I still think the fraud stuff ought to be front and center, along with the auditor's report. But, yeah, I think this is a very important thing that could really help out the audit committees in doing their job.
Yeah, we appreciate those comments.
Yeah, and the communication with the audit committees, Lynn, was not on the list last year, and I don't have a copy of Tom's remarks from last year, and his comments are on our website, and pretty certain he addressed it. We did get some consideration and you know, at a staff level, and it was not included on a priorities list, but certainly we have these discussions for a reason every year to get feedback, and there's been a number of members talking about communications with the audit committee, so we will certainly give that consideration. Barbara Roper.
Following on to what Lynn was just saying, part of what, when we talk about this and we keep talking about priorities and whatnot, I get the sense, given how many projects do seem to sort of drop off the list or take a protracted period of time, that we may be dealing with overly constrained resources that are being brought to bear on this task, and that there really needs, as you say, the budget is a work in progress, there really needs to be serious consideration given to whether this activity of the board is being adequately funded, and if areas are priorities and if they have been identified as important, some sort of formal assessment about what kind of funding level it would take to get them done, not just in the standard setting area but in other aspects of the board's activities as well, you know, ought to be part of that project, that process, and I hope it is, and I would hope that there would be some sort of transparency around those considerations. The other thing I wanted to talk about is a number of people have talked about the importance of convergence. And, you know, while I certainly think it is important that the board be cognizant of what other standard setters are doing and use that process to identify what they are doing well, I think that's a process that can be taken to extremes, and I would caution against that in the sense that I think once you make convergence an end in itself, it can be difficult to justify doing things differently, even when you think doing things differently would result in doing them better. And so while I think there is certainly a value to paying attention, close attention to what others are doing, finding out what works well, I don't think it should be made an end in itself by this board.
Thank you, Barbara. Are there any other comments regarding our standard setting accomplishments and priorities? I don't see any tent cards, but I'll just pause in case anyone has any final views or thoughts. Yes, Mark.
Let me make just a couple of observations. And first of all, I don't know that I've said it recently, but I doubt that the members of this group fully appreciate the extent to which we appreciate and take into consideration the input from the SAG. It is critically important to our thinking. I doubt that a day goes by where, in terms of how we are utilizing the board time and how we are determining priorities, that the input from the SAG isn't part of those decisions. So I would just like to say thank you for your consideration and thank you for the time you put in. I recognize that pro bono time means that you're here in place of doing something else, and for us to ask busy people and fully engaged people to spend their time here, we fully appreciate. Let me talk a little bit, just quickly. We have a very, I think an effective strategic planning process. The role of standard setting takes an important component of our strategic planning time, and the issues that you've raised today are all issues that we're spending a lot of time with, including the manner in which we work with other standard setters and the capacity outside of the PCA to be involved in that process. I think those are very valid comments. We have included them in our discussions, and we'll continue to include them in our discussions. I've said that publicly before, and I want to repeat it now that I think that that is very important. The transparency of the process is something that we also want to take into consideration, and your thoughts here are very valuable. And our budget process essentially flows from the strategic planning process, as it should, in any organization. And obviously we have to make choices. We feel we are fully accountable on that budget. The SEC, I know Paul, feels that we're fully accountable in that process. Paul is our point person in that effort, and I think he can probably speak to that issue. And so I just wanted to say to Barbara and others that those are issues that we do take into consideration, and your input here I think is very valuable to us. And I have a plane to catch, so if this goes long, I may have to leave early.
We're ending on time. That seems like an appropriate wrap-up for that section, so then just like to make some final remarks and close the session. Thank you so much for your input and feedback during this meeting. As Mark just said, your feedback is extremely important to us, and so I appreciate your efforts. I think this is a very good meeting, had a lot of great discussion, and we will go back and consider it in determining our future direction. This is the last scheduled meeting of 2008. As we get closer to when the 2009 meeting will be, we will announce that, but we haven't announced that or finalized on that yet. About half of the members' terms are expiring this year, and some of them are seeking reappointment. Not all of them are. We have not announced who those members will be, but we plan to do that shortly. But for those members whose terms are expiring this year and may or may not be back on for various reasons, I just want to extend gratitude for your contributions. And so thank you very much. Thank you again for your time during this meeting. Greatly appreciate it. And that concludes this session. So safe travels home. Thank you.